I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to you all to this Friends of the Library event and to the University of Adelaide and also to Science Week, which we're in this week. And this is a very appropriate week to consider the role of science in our community and in our well-being. The understanding in the general community about how science works, and thirdly, the rewards and the obstacles in the lives of scientists. And these are all topical and important issues. And I suspect the gap is getting wider between how science operates and the understanding of the general community about science. I'll give three instances that maybe suggest it's getting worse. The first one is the huge emphasis and investment in alternative medicine. In procedures that range from the remarkably useful to the fraudulent, the huge amount of investment and the economic burden this country spends in alternative medicine. Secondly, the way the politicians are tending more and more, if they want to claim authority in public debate, they will say, the science says this, as if that's the ultimate authority, without having the faintest idea what it actually means. And if you think back in the Middle Ages, the authority was the Pope. In the Roman times, it was the entrails of the sacrificed animals or the way that the birds flew. And now it's tending to be the politicians say, well, the science says this. And the third thing is that the response you get, if you're talking to someone at a party or in a bus and you happen to say you're a scientist, what's the response like? The scientists here, what response do you get? People look at you, they expect you to be unworldly, to be a nerd, to have higher thoughts, or somehow not to be like ordinary people. Scientists are thought not to be ordinary. Now, all of this is a gap and it's a problem that we need to address. There's an important need to relocate scientific activities into the mainstream of public thought and improve scientific literacy across the whole community and not just the people who deal with science. And this is exactly the area that Peter Doherty's book is addressing and trying to help us to improve. Now, Peter's one of Australia's most distinguished scientists, and he did his veterinary degree in Queensland, then became inspired by Macfarlane Burnet and his work on the immune system, did his PhD in Edinburgh. He then returned to Canberra to the John Curtin School, where together with Rolf Zinkernagel, he made his fundamental discovery of how the T cells of the immune system recognize antigens. This is a concept that now underpins all our understanding of the cellular immune system, the body's defense against infection, and many other conditions where the immune response is important, including recently efforts to control cancer in areas with the immune system. So Peter's received many honours and honorary degrees. I'll mention only two. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1966, the first veterinary graduate to receive this honour.
1996.
I'm sorry, 1996.
I would have been 26 years old in 1966.
Sorry.
I would have been just a year older than the younger Bragg.
The younger Bragg.
Who worked in Adelaide.
That's right.
He's the youngest person who won a Nobel Prize until the young lady, the young Pakistani lady who won the Peace Prize for being shot.
That's right.
That's right.
And of course also, he was Australian of the Year, came in 1997. He's been in recent years on the staff of the Department of Immunology at St. Jude's Research Hospital in Memphis, coming Tennessee, and also as a professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology in Melbourne, and he's been sharing his year between those two sites. So his book, which is called The Knowledge Wars, it explains how scientific method is used, how the modern science industry functions, the checks and balances that operate in our modern science industry that are used to test evidence, the fallacies, the misconceptions that occur in science, and much more. It's an important guide for lay people to understand what this all means and how it's operating, but it's also has invaluable advice for practicing scientists. Now, we haven't got copies of this for sale tonight, but you can buy this online from Melbourne University Press. If you go to the website for Melbourne University Press, and in the search window, if you type in knowledge, that's what you're looking for, and this book comes up, and you can buy it online instantly and very, very easily. So without saying any more, I'll hand over to Peter, and we'll hear some more about his book and his thesis.
Oh, thanks. I think this is a 2015 book. I think this is probably my last public performance. I thought I'd done most of the writers' festivals. I hadn't been asked to the Adelaide one, so now this is my Adelaide talk, but I don't think I have done all the writers' festivals because they keep starting up all the time. There's so many writers' festivals, and I think they've become quite an important economic feature in many towns in Australia, in fact. And if you look at the this parallel importation law and so forth that our friends in the Productivity Commission, the Productivity Commission, if you're not really aware of it, is an organisation in Canberra that understands the commodification of nothing, everything, and the value of nothing. And they want to ruin our publishing industry, basically. That's what about. And they're going to ruin a whole lot of great events in towns that are actually kind of struggling financially and need every dollar they can get. So I hope every one of you is lobbying, and if you know your local member or you can get to them, you're letting them know exactly what you think about it. And Jane Lomax-Smith will put you in the right direction if you don't know how to do that. But I think by the age of most of us, we've got some ideas on how to do that sort of thing. Chris mentioned, I'm just going to ramble on a bit. I've got a whole 40 minutes, so I'm not used to having 40 minutes. Last time I was in Adelaide, I had to give a 10-minute talk at a dinner. And for the first time in my life, I dried up at 7 minutes. And it scared the hell out of me. And I realise I'm getting older. And so for some of this evening, you're going to have to endure my reading, because I've started to write things out. And what you're going to get from what I read out is the talk I gave last year at the Festival of Dangerous Ideas in Sydney, which was a lot of fun, actually. Dangerous Ideas are really good. It was in the Opera House. Chris mentioned I went to Memphis. You may wonder why I went to Memphis. Well, I was a professor at the Australian National University, and I became involved in an effort to reform the Australian National University. And I heard a wonderful quote last week at the Byron Bay Writers' Festival. It was about education. I mean, there are a few quotes about reforming universities. Trying to reform a university is like moving a graveyard. It's not pleasant, smells bad, and the inhabitants don't help you. The other quote was a quote about education. It said, if you wish, and I'm going to substitute academic rather than education. If you wish to become involved, if you wish to climb the mountain of academic reform, be prepared that this is the hill that you will die on. So that's why I spent a long time in Memphis, Tennessee. Actually, it was a great experience for various reasons I won't go into. Now, I won the Nobel Prize in 1996, so that's 20 years ago, it's the 20th anniversary. And as Chris said, we won the Nobel Prize for what we found out about the killer T cells. These are white blood cells in the body that are actually serial killers. They kill other cells. They kill cells that are growing viruses. That's what helps stop an infection. And we've always known they could kill cancer cells. And one of the really gratifying things over the last couple of years is that the research that's been going on since then, not with us, but with other people doing it, we've known for many years that these cells are sitting in a lot of tumours. specifically melanomas, but they're not doing anything. And we've tried all sorts of things to wake them up, because we know if we can wake them up and make them start killing, they'll just kill and kill and kill and kill. And basically, they worked out how to wake them up. And about 30% of melanomas now, which would have been totally fatal, people are getting complete recovery. And that's because they're using what we call a monoclonal antibody against what's called a checkpoint inhibitor to turn the cells back on. And now, for instance, Ron Walker, the Melbourne entrepreneur, who I think was partly involved in stealing the Grand Prix from Adelaide and getting it to Melbourne, was almost dead with melanoma. They gave him this stuff, and he's had, I think, his 5-year survival already. He's in great shape. So it's really an enormous advance, and it's very gratifying after all that 20 years. But that gives you a kind of idea of the time frame of actually moving from discovery to actual useful application. And sometimes we're very naive about that, especially in the way we talk about it in the political sphere as far as translating scientific discoveries. So we came back to Australia. The thing that brought us back to Australia, I was happily ensconced in Memphis, Tennessee. After my experience at ANU, I was never going to come back here and never work in a university again. But what actually brought us back is that I was made Australian of the Year. At that stage, they didn't do the Australian of the Year the way they do now, where they have a sort of a beauty contest in Canberra. It was done the way things should be done. That is, a group of people in a black room with a bottle of claret decided who, or Shiraz, I've no doubt, decided who'd be the Australian of the Year. And they picked me because I won the Nobel Prize. And they always made Nobel Prize winners. Even though I was living in Memphis, Tennessee, I was the Australian of the Year. So I came back here 4 or 5 times for protracted periods because they wanted us to visit all the capital cities. And I met so many terrific people, and really just realised how many really good people there are truly trying to do things in Australia. Jane Lomax Smith was one of them. I think you were Lord Mayor then, Jane, was it? Yeah, and it was just great. And so started coming back for 3 months a year. We had a son and some grandchildren starting to emerge. And then I switched in 2002, and we started to come back. We decided to spend 9 months back here at University of Melbourne and then 3 months at Memphis, and I've gradually been bringing the thing in Memphis to a close. So it's still a wonderful institution, and I still go there every year for a reasonable amount of time. So it's been great coming back, but I'd been writing a lot of articles for the newspapers and for magazines and so forth, and I write okay. I've been writing all my life, after all, not literary writing, obviously, but writing scientific papers and reviews. And an agent got hold of me, Mary Kinane, who'd been a publisher in the United States. She'd actually handled Stephen Jay Gould. She had handled J.P. Donlevy. She didn't like either of them, actually. They were both pretty unpleasant. And she came to Australia and became a literary agent for reasons of affection, shall we say. So she said I should write a book. So then she got Louise Adler on my case. I don't know whether you've seen Louise, but I'm easily manipulated by small, intense women, and Louise is short and intense. And she's Jewish as well, which makes it even harder. And she's wonderful, and I love her. And she's married to Max Gillies, actually. So she got me to write a book. And the book which I wrote, I want to write a book about science and process and how it's done and try and interest young people in science. And they gave it the extravagant title of The Beginner's Guide to Winning the Nobel Prize, which has always been somewhat of an embarrassment. But it's sold all over the world, and it's been translated into multiple languages, all because it's got a cute little picture of me on the front on a tricycle at the age of 3, and because of the title, not because of its inherent worth. It required enormous editing. I had no idea of how to write a book, and it has really good things in the back, telling you how to win the Nobel Prize, like discover something really big. And so, and it's just come out as another thing, and it's still being translated. We just sold the Italian translation. I thought they were more sophisticated than that. And so after that, I got the writing bug, and I got better at it. And the next book didn't get much editing at all. So I'd become like a lot of older biologists, and this included McFarlane Burnet, and included Adelaide's great Frank Fenner, who was one of the professors in Canberra when I was there. Wonderful guy, and I think he won the Japan Prize. He was absolutely key to the elimination of smallpox. And Chris has just done a new edition of the classic Fenner and White virology text. And I was very privileged to be asked to write a foreword to it, where I made all sorts of extravagant comments, as one does in a foreword. Anyway, the book's coming out soon. And so, but Fenner became very obsessed with what was happening in environmental issues. And he actually moved from medical science into environmental science. And now the operation he founded in Canberra is called the Fenner School of the Environment. And it's a very substantial operation. But I think many of us who are interested in biology are very interested in what's happening in the environment, what's happening with global warming and so forth. And basically, the type of training we've had, I actually started as a vet, not as a medical doctor, but we're trained to think in terms of duty of care. And I think as we look at what's happening globally and the planet and so forth, we think, the thinking is we need to actually practice the preventive medicine for the planet, the preventive medicine for life. We need this duty of care in our perception of what we're doing. And of course, that doesn't necessarily occur to politicians. And so the next book after The Beginner's Guide, I wrote a light history of hot air. I read up on global warming. I wrote a totally undisciplined book. It goes everywhere from global warming to my primary school teacher to sop with camels in World War I to refrigeration. I love the book. It's actually been, it was reasonably popular in Australia, meaning it sold maybe 4,000 or 5,000 copies, which is about anything sells much. But the Americans could never quite work out what to do with it. And the one publisher who wanted to publish it went broke in the global financial crisis. And then I did a book called Sentinel Chickens, which is a lot about the work we do with influenza and so forth, because that's maintained in birds. And it's about some of the people who worked with these infections. It's about birds monitoring the world, birds and hot and heat, birds and environmental degradation, and all sorts of things like that. It got published in the US. And then I did a book called Pandemics, What Everyone Needs to Know, which of course was immediately out of date because we had some more pandemics. But what I realized after publishing these books and talking to people is that what I was putting in the books, I thought was very simple, very clear, very, very straightforward. But for a lot of people, even the simplest science was really quite intimidating. And that surprised me. I thought I was talking at a level where pretty much anyone could understand. I realized that I wasn't. I was still too far up here. So I decided I needed to write a book about science and how it works that has no science in it. And that's what The Knowledge Wars is. It's basically a book about science for non-scientists and for people who may not even like science. And what it does initially, well, I'll tell you what it does when I read through my script. And then I'll say a bit more about it. So this is my dangerous ideas talk. You're not too offended at being read to, actually. One of the reasons I wanted to write books is Memphis, strangely enough, has a very good literary program in the local university. And we had people like John Updike and Peter Carey and so forth come down and give talks, and then we'd buy their books and they'd sign the books and so forth. And what really impressed me is when I go and give a talk, I spend time preparing it, I have PowerPoint presentations, do all this work. These guys would just come along and read from their goddamn book. I mean, what a really a free pass they were getting. But I won't bore you from reading through the book. I'll read from this. So this is my dangerous ideas. Science is wonderful, illuminating, and at times dangerous, and that's long been understood. In the structured world of Europe's medieval dark ages, dominated by rigid dress codes, strict hierarchies, and a wealthy and corrupt church, any inquiry that could lead to change was dangerous, both to the established social structure and for those who were found to have transgressed. We went back to that recently in the Abbott government. I think Abbott is one of the best minds of the 14th century, really. But And those long dead authoritarians weren't. Have I offended someone in the audience? I can't imagine there are any avid enthusiasts in an audience like this. Poor Tony. Yeah. No, I've lost my strength. Yes. Those long dead authoritarians weren't totally wrong when they fired up the brushwood to burn those who had temerity to think and speak out. I didn't realise that the reason the church had to burn people is it couldn't spill blood, but it can incinerate them. So it's a bit like lawyers today's drink. If that medieval idea of an essentially static world had been sustained, we'd have no problem today with global overpopulation, anthropogenic global warming, and nursing home full of cardiac survivors who now have Alzheimer's disease. Basically, we'd all be dead. And still, most of us likely prefer to have TV and antibiotics and live longer and healthier lives. Of course, ISIS would take us back to that, in the way, sort of decreasing human population at a fairly rapid rate. We now have seven times as many people on this planet as we had in 1800. The world population, I was born in 1940, the world population has increased at least 2.5 times since I was born. So one can see that a lot of the issues that we're facing are really due to the numbers of us. And the really great fear, of course, is that someone who's really a very unpleasant person might try to reduce those numbers. That's one of the dystopian plots for sci-fi virus novels, you know, the guy who creates the virus to kill off the human population because there are too many of them. I have to be careful what I say in public. This is being recorded and broadcast, isn't it? So, well, anyway, I'm not doing that sort of science, I assure you. But really, when the Black Death hit England in the 14th century, it killed somewhere between 1/2 and 1/3 of the population. And the Black Death raged in Europe for hundreds of years. And yet, the germ theory of infectious disease dates to about 1860. Louis Pasteur, 1860. So it's only in the last 150 years that we've actually understood, 160 years, we've understood what an infectious disease is. I find this all quite extraordinary. You know, if you look at blood, okay, William Harvey, Galen, the great, this has got nothing to do with the book, but Galen, the great Roman physician, believed the blood was made in the heart and drained to the liver, or something like that. That made it perfectly acceptable to bleed people because the blood's just going one way and you get rid of the bad blood. But when you've got recirculating blood, bleeding people makes no sense at all. But they did it for hundreds of years. I mean, for God knows, they may still be doing it in some alternative medicine clinics. But Harvey, the guy who worked this out, he went to the medical school in Padua, which was a medical school that had broken away from the church. They were actually dissecting and doing things that the church didn't approve of. And Harvey worked out the circulation of the blood. But William Harvey didn't know why the blood was red. Shakespeare, when he writes about Lady Macbeth, you know, the blood she can't wash her, they don't know why the blood is red. We didn't know why blood was red until he wasn't actually an optician or an optical person, but he had the hobby of microscopy till Leeuwenhoek in the Netherlands used very, very simple microscopes, just single tiny little lenses that were very carefully ground and looked at blood and he could see red blood cells. And so we discovered the red blood cells in the 17th century. We didn't know we had red blood cells. We didn't know until the 19th century that we had white blood cells because they're so much scarcer. And then we only found that out because we got better microscopes. And then the 19th century saw enormous advances in our understanding of cells and cell theory of pathology and all the rest of it. So really modern medicine is, in many cases, it's certainly less than 150 years old, many cases less than 100 years old. And then, of course, we've been going through this enormous revolution in molecular medicine. This has not much to do with the book. Okay, so we get back to the theme of my dangerous ideas. So the equivalent of the Holy Inquisition today for those who pursue science that's inconvenient to the rich and powerful is public vilification, cash for comment opinion makers, I won't name anyone, plus the loss of research funding and jobs. Fortunately, where some progressive politicians try to compromise that culture of rigorous inquiry. They soon discover that the horse has bolted and it's too late to shut the stable door. Science is global. The findings are available to anyone. And if suppressed in one place, the enterprise inevitably prospers elsewhere. Politicians who find science dangerous and identify with alternative invented narratives inevitably experience loss of credibility on both the international and local scene. And if voters don't boot them out at their first possible opportunity, that odium extends to the nation state. That could be both dangerous and costly in an environmentally hostile future. I worry about our sort of position in the world as for instance, a major fossil fuel producer. If you think about it, and if the what the climate scientists say is going to happen, the consequences are going to be very, very bad indeed. And with about, I think, 0.3% of the world's 0.03% of the world's population, we produce about 1.5% of the greenhouse gases. And if you take our coal exports, we're actually about number five or number six in the world. And if somebody's going to take after a country for being a causative in global warming, they're not going to take on the United States and China, but we're a pretty easy target. Disruptive technologies disrupt. Even for some time after 1989, when Tim Berners-Lee Insights initiated the World Wide Web, nobody understood the massive social and economic changes that would be brought about by the internet. If retailers and trade unions had grasped that, would modern communications technology have been as vehemently opposed as efforts to put a global price on dumping carbon into the atmosphere? The change, the massive change that the World Wide Web has caused in employment, in communication, just sneaked up on us. We didn't notice. We didn't understand what would happen. And I think many people still don't understand. Australian businesses were very, very slow to react to online trading, for instance, and didn't work out what was happening. Then the transfer of call centres, and you know, if we can transfer call centres to the Philippines, why can't we transfer accounting and will making to India, or as has already happened, if people are qualified, say in the United States, to read radiology scans, if they have those board certifications, say in California, they can do that in Noosa, which is actually a pretty good way to live, really, when you think about it. The World Wide Web has probably cost us a great deal more than would have been required to transition to a low carbon economy, but we just didn't pick that it was happening. And also, transitioning to a low carbon economy, as South Australia has realised, creates a spectrum of different local economic opportunities and jobs, but it does require resources to do it. Working with its high-powered sisters of technology and engineering, science provides outcomes that are good, blood pressure medication, bad, mustard gas, and sometimes a bit of both, music and elevators. And that transformation of the human reality over the past three centuries, well, you really couldn't have a string quartet in the elevator with you, so over the past three centuries, was enabled by a number of other interrelated changes. The findings of scientists, which must be published for all to read, would have remained hidden if it were not for the 15th century invention of the printing press. We wouldn't have modern science without the printing press, because you have to publish so that people can read the work and repeat it. That took a while to become established. There was a hard-fought rear action by the designated keepers of knowledge, allowing ordinary citizens to access information directly published in books and pamphlets. I mean, Tyndale, the first, I think, to translate the English Bible, was burned at the stake. But much of Tyndale's Bible is actually in the King James Bible. So Tyndale survives, and survives triumphantly, though he had a rather unpleasant exit. So the application of technology was driven forward by adventurous entrepreneurs who depended in turn on the emergence of banking houses. I think maybe the Dutch or maybe the Swiss were the first to start banking houses, patent offices, the availability of insurance and credit, and ethical accounting that led to confidence for investors. So that whole period, we take the modern era as sort of starting with Francis Bacon and the books about how modern science developed. That's the first part of the book. We take Bacon and his ideas about inductive reasoning and so forth as the beginning of modern science. But in fact, modern science would not have emerged without all those, that social opening out and that setting up of ethical, solid institutions that were trustworthy through commerce and business and all the rest of it. Now, with the rise of the internet, search engines and online open access to scientific papers and review articles, part of my intent in the knowledge wars is to show anyone who is interested how they can access science for themselves and check out the credentials of those who claim to have specialist expertise. So the book starts initially by talking about science, how it developed, how it works, and a little bit about what scientists do and how they train. But most of that is actually in my earlier book, The Beginner's Guide to Winning the Nobel Prize. But it, at the end, because it's kind of technical and a bit unpalatable and boring to read, there are a series of appendices which tell you how to find a scientist online, how to look up a scientific paper, how to interpret a scientific paper because it's written in a funny sort of format, and what peer review means and all these things we discussed. So that's in, at the back. But if anyone's really interested in looking up whether someone who claims expertise in science, and many people do, actually has any expertise, then you can look them up and you can see, have they published anything in science? Have they published in peer-reviewed journals? Even if you don't understand the science, you can see whether they have any status whatsoever in science. And if you're worried about people who bang along, for instance, about empirical evidence, that's one way to find out that they're not really very credible. And looking up this sort of stuff doesn't really require any commitment to scientific jargon or technical detail, but it helps to know a bit about this culture. So the book deals with little with the history of science in society, who scientists are and how they train and operate. The word science didn't even exist in English until the mid-19th century. It was coined because they just didn't have a word for scientists. There was a word for artists, and artists sort of go back to the cave dwellings, but there was no word for scientist. And talking about the scientists and how they train and operate, I also give what's basically a warts and all view of contemporary science. Progress and process is what the knowledge wars is about. The primary target audience is non-scientists and so forth. For those who might be more literary and turned away from science in high school, it's worth recalling that the 17th century Renaissance man or woman was deeply interested in the science of natural philosophy of that time. In fact, Isaac Newton would never have described himself as a scientist. He would describe himself as a natural philosopher. And I guess Charles Darwin would also. Knowledge is complex and often specialised. Nobody today could make the 17th century claim that all knowledge is my province. That's what Francis Bacon said. The text here breaks back and forth between my varied perspectives. It's written from my perspective as an insider in biomedical science. I know about biomedical science. I know the warts and all views of, features of it. I know where the bodies are buried and I know where it goes wrong and so forth. I got a pretty good understanding of it. And then as an outsider in climate science, I've been talking a lot to climate scientists. I listen to them. I've chaired a board of an ARC climate science center and all the rest of it. But I'm not able to really evaluate that science in great detail because the technology, largely mathematical information, computational and all the rest of it, is not something I do. And so I have to rely on trust. But in fact, all modern science relies on trust. We now, when we used to publish a paper, when I started out, and when Chris started out, there would be four or five people at the most on the paper. We'd all know exactly what was done. We'd all know exactly the techniques. Now when we publish a research paper, there's likely to be 20 authors on it. There's likely to be a number of different activities that require very high technology approaches and complex instrumentation. No one person who's an author on that paper understands the whole thing. So we're depending totally on the trust of that. On trust and on the integrity of our colleagues. And on the whole, it works pretty well, but sometimes it goes wrong. In the book itself, there's no science, there's no graphs to deal with, there's no unfamiliar words. The biggest word was epistemology, but that got taken out. And that's not even a scientific word, that's philosophical. I don't hide in any sense what I think. I think modern biomedical research and science does a great job and it's really helped us. And I think the climate scientists are legitimate. But I'm not asking people to take my word for it. What I'm trying to do is give people the tools to actually find out for themselves. Knowledge is power. Ipsa scientia potestas. est. That's what Francis Bacon, Lord Verulam, former High Chancellor under James I of England, James VI of Scotland, wrote as he'd, I lived in Edinburgh, you didn't dare call Elizabeth I of England. She was Elizabeth II of Scotland and when I was there. Queen Elizabeth is Elizabeth I, yes, of Scotland. She's Elizabeth II of England. James was James I of England, James VI of Scotland. Credited with formulating the idea of inductive reasoning, Bacon's dangerous idea is that we must interrogate nature directly. That's not what people were doing. Rather than basing our views on precedent, authority, or common sense, we have to look at the thing itself. The basic requirement is that, after deciding that measurements should be made and how to make them, a systematically acquired body of data is interpreted, discussed, and written up as a coherent narrative. Then, after critical assessment by two or more independent and authoritative individuals, peer review, the information must be published openly for anyone who is interested to critique, and if so desired, to repeat and or extend the work. Following these simple rules for subverting the mind filters imposed by belief, authority, and shared prejudice has exposed the underlying nature of reality and driven the development of our contemporary world. These rules were first set in place in the 17th century in the Royal Society of London, which is the British Academy of Science. It was chartered by King James II in 1642, I think it was. And it's the Academy of the British Academy of Science, and it's also the Commonwealth Academy of Science. This little button is actually the Royal Society. And the first ever scientific journal in English, the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, was published under those words, went under those rules, a peer review, a rigorous assessment. Leeuwenhoek's work from the Netherlands was published in the Royal, in the Philosophical Transactions via Robert Hooke, who was the sort of curator of experiments of the Royal Society, probably the first professional scientist in England who actually had some employment as a scientist. And Jenner actually didn't, when he did his groundbreaking work on discovering that cowpox could protect against smallpox, his paper was rejected by the Philosophical Transactions because he didn't have a big enough group size. So he had to publish a pamphlet. Now we would write it online, so I guess. So though the Industrial Revolution was already well underway by 1800, it was through those next 100 years that we saw the first ocean-going steamships, the first steam railways, the development of sanitary principles, antisepsis in surgery and childbirth, the germ theory of infectious disease, and the founding of the first dedicated research institutes, the emergence of science disciplines in universities, and the beginnings of career structures for professional researchers. And of course, our Australian universities, our older Australian universities date from that period. I think University of Adelaide is about 1853 or something. 54. Melbourne, I think, is 1853 or something. Sydney is older, and Hobart is older, I think. So they're our first Australian universities. And this was happening. Queensland didn't get a university until after the First World War. And the reason it didn't get a university until after the First World War is that the good citizens of Queensland were worried that their young men, after being corrupted by the university, would become white-gloved aesthetes who would not work the land. What changed their mind was the understanding of the American Agricultural and Mechanical University, and also going back to the model of the Scottish universities. And actually, all our universities, as I understand them, are much more founded, though we make a lot of fuss about Oxford and Cambridge, they're actually much more founded on the model of the Scottish universities, which were open to everyone, did not require you to be a communicant of the Church of England, and were pretty basic and down-to-earth operations. In Edinburgh, how basic they were, in Edinburgh when I was there, the university still had a midterm holiday called Meal Day. It was so the students could go back to their village and get another bag of oats to see them through the rest of the year. I don't know whether you have that in Adelaide or not. So, yeah. Today, basic discovery science is largely funded by government grants, especially the US National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, our own National Health and Medical Research Council and Australia Research Council. There are also big players in the philanthropic sector, particularly the Wellcome Foundation, Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and William and Melinda Gates Foundation. Some of those funds are accessible to us. We get some funds from the Gates Foundation. We've been closed largely out of welcome. There is now some welcome money coming in. But in general, Australia's public spending on science has been reasonable, but private foundations tend to be few, fairly small, and the science, business and entrepreneurial culture is still too limited in scope. There are honourable exceptions. In a way, though, that's gone backwards a bit because we've so dependent on mining. And of course, we're seeing the effects of that. The basic rules of science mandate that scientists behave with integrity, and because of the diversity of skill sets that are required to complete a contemporary analysis, the whole thing works on trust or confidence that everyone is playing correctly by the rules. That's what peer reviewers are supposed to work out. But all they can really do, in fact, is say that the science looks to have been properly done, that the findings are interesting, and the case is properly argued. Scientists are not priests or popes, despite Chris's... No science paper is holy writ. It's there to be critiqued, perhaps attacked, and to contribute what is frequently an emerging story. In the main, old science papers are only of historical interest in that what they described is sound, the whole science of that becomes incorporated. Everyone says, we always knew that. And if it's wrong, it just fades away. I think I'm running out of time, actually. I've gone on too long. How long... Yeah, so I can't read you all this wonderful document that I've written. I just have to go to the end. The book has a section on the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's fraud and criminality in science. There is some, particularly in the medical sciences, because it's a small laboratory culture. It's easy for people to fake, and there's a lot of pressure there. It's very hard to envisage how someone would fake in, for instance, climate science. In these big analyses that people do, where you have massive data sets, they're online, they're provided by people like the Bureau of Meteorology, NASA, America's National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, government agency, actually a commissioned corps. The members of it can be required to wear a uniform, Met Bureau office. These agencies are generating data from diver boys in the oceans, from satellites, and there's a mass of this stuff coming in. You cannot possibly analyze the massive data that's coming in without big complex computational systems and without modeling. And in fact, our weather forecasting is now based on computer modeling, and that's why it's actually got better, because the models are adjusted as you get more data in. Skepticism and denial, there's a discussion of skepticism and denial, what it means. I think if we're talking about the skeptical scientist, the way you tell the skeptical scientist, the one who's genuinely skeptical and not trying to prove a point, is whether they remain engaged with the science. What happens in science is new data comes in, we adjust our position depending on what the data says. So we have an idea of the way things are, stuff's been published, and then some new data comes in, and it may change that a bit. It may change it a lot, but it may change it a bit. And so if someone is a genuine skeptic of a particular area of science, and all of us are skeptical, skepticism is central to science, what you will see with a skeptic is someone who is adjusting their position just the way someone who is desperately involved in the science will adjust their position, because they want to know what's happening. They're not there to disprove something. They're there to say, well, we're not really convinced of this, but if we really care about it, we're going to stay in touch and see what's actually happening. There have been issues of massive criminality in conventional science. One is the Tuskegee experiment in America, where a large number of black men who developed syphilis were monitored by the American Public Health Service. But they weren't given any advice. They transmitted the disease to wives and children. No advice was given to the spouses. And even worse, when penicillin came along, which was a perfectly good treatment, they looked after these people, they gave them medical care, and they buried them. But when penicillin came along, they were denied penicillin so they could complete the study. It was absolutely outrageous. People were so outraged when the story broke. That's why we now have all these very strong ethical committees in universities looking at anything that's done with people or with animals. They're very, very rigorous committees. They have people on them who are lay people, who have nothing to do with medical science, because sometimes scientists can get a bit off base. What was even worse is in Guatemala, the US Public Health Service actually injected some people with syphilis. And the excuse was they'd all be treated with penicillin. But the sort of people they were injecting were not necessarily the people who would come back and get treated. So again, that was horrific. President Obama apologized for that recently. Skepticism and denial. Scientists live by their reputation. The one thing, we're not faceless. Our name is what finds us. Our name is what gives us our reputation. And so we don't want that name damaged. And that's the most important thing to us, is reputation. And so the idea of some sort of conspiracy, especially some sort of conspiracy that involves older people, as has been suggested for climate science by, well, a recent senator, for instance, the idea that bright young people, young physicists, mathematicians, the very brightest scientists we have, would join some conspiracy of the elders about climate science is totally absurd. I mean, these are your sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters. You know what they're like. And they're not going to join some conspiracy that's led by old farts. I mean, really, it's just ridiculous. There are also scientists who get conflicted because they're working for the coal industry. So anyway, that's about as far as I can go. You have to read the book if you want to find out more about it. You probably don't want to at this stage. So in some conclusions, the laws of nature are inexorable and we have little, if any, control. Human beings are constructs of nature. It's not the other way around. Disruptive technologies that operate ultimately to our benefit are neither predictable nor, at least initially, necessarily recognised, and they can make enormous differences. When we face a major and cumulative problem like climate change, while major technical innovation like nuclear fusion, that's not nuclear fission, nuclear fusion, for electricity generation is possible, we cannot rely on working it that we will be able to do it, and we can't rely on it happening. So we must proceed with whatever incremental scientists and corrective steps we can take. Science and technology can do a lot, but we will not achieve a sustainable future without changing both some of our practices and some of what we value. Democracy cannot prosper if both politicians and voters are scientifically illiterate. We all need to remove the filters and access what is real. And so that's what this book is written for. It's written to try and give people an overview of science, a view of where it's good, where it can be bad, how it works, and how you can take a look at it for yourself. And I hope it is useful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is a fascinating journey that you've taken us on. But I'm sure you'd be happy to answer some questions from the audience.
Yeah, that might give some clarification.
Just wondered if you'd sent a copy of it to Senator-elect Malcolm Roberts.
Before Malcolm was elected, and after this book was published, he clearly saw it and was offended by it in some way. Because it says that once you become a denier, you get trapped, especially if you get a lot of money in one way or another for it. Okay, so he got in touch with me, and I got this thing from Malcolm Roberts, and I didn't know who he was. And it seemed to make reasonable sense, so what I did is I did what I advise people to do in the book. I looked up Malcolm Roberts. I looked him up in the Web of Science, which has all the publications from right across science. You don't have to, you can't access that unless you're in a university usually, but you can access Google Scholar, which will let you do the same thing. Anyone can access Google Scholar. So I looked him up and I found a Malcolm Roberts, an M. Roberts, at the University of East Anglia Climate Science Centre. So I said, are you this M. Roberts? And he said, no, he's not. So then I did what I should have done in the first place and put Malcolm Roberts into the search engine. I got Malcolm Roberts Galileo. And the Galileo thing is a total misinterpretation of Galileo. They think by standing up against climate science, they're the great unconventional scientists like Galileo that are standing up against the authority of the church. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between the real thing and a turkey, but, you know, basically. So anyway, I had some more interchange with him, and I said, well, you know, have you ever published anything in the scientific literature or done any science? And are you the Malcolm Roberts from Galileo? He says, yes, I'm very proud of that. And so then I got no answer. I can never get an answer from him, but he sent me a whole lot of stuff. which I looked at. It was impenetrable. I couldn't get into it at all. It was just incomprehensible to me. And so so then I said, well, you know, there's some interesting, you say you want to have, he goes on about empirical evidence, if you saw him on Q&A. I've never actually heard a scientist ever say the word, say empirical evidence. What they say is, you know, what's the data, or what are you finding, or what do you think? But I've never heard anyone say empirical evidence, but it sounds very portentous, it sounds very important. So he keeps saying empirical evidence. He's got a very interesting position. He keeps asking for empirical evidence, but then he thinks, and he must base it on some science that he got somewhere, because the evidence about climate change all comes out of science at some stage, or the evidence about global temperature all comes somewhere from science. But then his position is that the people generating the evidence, the scientists, are all corrupt, so he can't look at the evidence they generate. So it's a perfect closed system. And, you know, crackpots always have these things. And so then I tried sending him some PDFs of papers that I thought were pretty straightforward and had some evidence, and, you know, never got anything back. And then the whole thing just died. We agreed we didn't have much to say to each other, and the next thing he's in the bloody Senate, for Christ. So, you know, we may look at him and we may say he looks crazy, but what he says will resonate with some people, and no publicity is bad publicity. So, to your satisfaction, he dealt with him satisfactorily. To my satisfaction, but to the satisfaction of some people who'd be watching, not so much the ABC actually, but some of the people who watch television, it would have just been an arrogant guy doing a put down of a real hero. And that's the problem. That's the problem.
I know.
But you know, well, actually, I don't know what percentage of people watch Q&A. What is it, 20%, 50%?
4%.
Yeah, I have a sort of idea that, you know, at the most 20% of people ever watch the ABC. And it's the same in the US with the public broadcasting service. So what we think is obvious and rational doesn't get out there at all. And it's, you know, I mean, if you really want to have a bad day, start the day being on breakfast television trying to sell a book. And it's not so much what you say, it's what you have to listen to before they put you on. And you think, I want to kill myself now.
If I could ask perhaps Peter that, I think we'd all agree that school teaching of science is crucial to get more scientific literacy right across the board. Which countries do you think do this best, and what should we be doing in schools?
Well, I think a general science literacy is probably much, much higher in European countries, and certainly in Scandinavian countries. Scandinavia does a pretty good job, I think. But, you know, Scandinavia, Germany, they've got a long history of education and science driving the economy. If you go back, you know, I mentioned the discovery of the white blood cell. The white blood cells were discovered about 1842. By 1900, initially they were called the colourless corpuscles because they could see them down the microscope, but all they could see was they were colourless, they weren't red. That's all, because there was... And then Paul Ehrlich came along, and the German dye industry, which had grown... Have you ever read the book Purple? It's about how the dye industry was initially developed in England for indigo, and then it was taken over by the Germans, who then developed this wonderful chemical industry out of the dyes. And some of the early drugs, like Salvarsan for syphilis and so forth, were dyes, basically. So Paul Ehrlich, who is we talk about as the father of immunology, he was using the dyes, and he used them to stain these cells. And then you can see there are all sorts of different cells. And it moved forward very quickly because of the dyes. And that's when they started staining tissues. You know, if you look down a microscope and you see this little slice of tissue that's been sliced on a sort of a bacon slicer called a cryostat, and it's a bit of liver or something, it's blue and red. And these are the dyes, hematoxylin, eosin, various dyes that have different chemical properties, so they stain differently. And that really opened up the whole thing. And it started that great German industry, and it started a very close relationship between industry, university, business in general, and that drove the economy. And that has done that through those Germanic countries. And I'm including Scandinavia as Germanic because Scandinavia has a Germanic intellectual tradition. It has a Germanic academic tradition. It's not like our British. On the other hand, the Brits always treated engineers as yobs who, you know, greased. We used to call them greasers at the University of Queensland. And they never really, even though they have wonderful people, Scotland was much better about it. But the Brits, you know, it's kind of lower order stuff. It was kind of the British thinking. You know, the British civil service, when I was in Edinburgh, I talked to some of the guys who were senior British civil servants. And they were all classics. They graduated in classics or in PPE, philosophy, politics, economics. None of them knew any science. If they told me, well, if they put us into running, say, medicine or healthcare delivery, it's okay for a while, but once we really get to know it, then we're immediately transferred out again because we're getting too close to the constituency. That is, they actually knew something about what they were doing. And that's been a disaster for the UK. So, anyway.
You mentioned before that in medical science has made a few maybe wrong turns. I wonder if you could...
There's a number of cases of fraud in the medical science. The well-documented case, medical scientists who commit fraud in the United States and do so, and they're funded by government grants, can and do go to prison. There's an Office of Research Integrity that investigates them, and they can go to jail. There's a novel about it, actually, one of the few novels about laboratory life called Intuition by Allegra Goodman. She spent some time in an MIT research lab and then wrote this novel. She usually writes about the Jewish experience, but it's not bad. Maybe there was a fraud and maybe there wasn't, and it goes through all the personal tensions and so forth that result from it. And the other, the big frauds in medical science have been in sociology, and a Dutch guy called Staple, Japan. Sometimes what's called fraud is because people didn't get proper approvals. That's also treated as fraud. But really faking is because medical labs are kind of small, and because it's possible, because a lot of the experimental stuff is so complex and so forth, that it's possible to fake. The case that I talked about in the book is a case that happened at MIT, and it was a very bright young guy called Luc Van Parijs, who was a young associate professor. I remember this guy, he's kind of half in my field. And he was one of the real stars. You know, Luc was terrific, he was doing great stuff. But there were people who were kind of worried they couldn't repeat his work. Andreas Strasser, who's a great scientist in Melbourne at the Hall Institute, couldn't repeat it. He was very skeptical. And then and some of the people in the lab were getting a bit worried by a few things that I won't go into. And he had a lab of about five or six, about five postdoctoral people and one graduate student. And I got this whole story from the graduate student who's later working at St. Jude. And what happened was Luke was on the circuit, and they just all happened to be at a meeting where he spoke. And they knew Luke wasn't in the lab anymore. He wasn't doing lab experiments. They were doing the experiments. He was writing it up. He was doing what scientists do and get the money and talk about it and so forth. And he put up an experiment. And they turned to each other and said, did you do that experiment? Did you do that experiment? None of them had done the experiment. And so they had already been a bit concerned. So these are the young guys. And these are the guys that if he's discredited, they're going to lose their jobs. So they went to the MIT administration and they said, we're really concerned about this, what should we do? MIT administration, I'm not sure this is a great way to do it, but they said, well, confront him with it, see what he says, and then get back to us. So they confronted him with it, he denied it for about half an hour, and then he admitted it. And then the only reason he didn't go to jail is he went straight to the MIT administration and he said, I faked this data, and what's more, I've been faking all my career. He'd faked his PhD work, he'd faked his postdoctoral work. His postdoctoral work was with David Baltimore, another Nobel Prize winner. And he'd faked in his lab. Not everything, just a bit. In actual fact, he was smart enough so that what he faked, some of it's turned out to be right. But that doesn't make it any better. So the guy destroyed his career for nothing. And you get a lot of reversals in science. We fail a lot. But obviously this guy wasn't able to handle it. There's a good book that's just been written on scientific misconduct by Melbourne lawyer Ian Freckleton. You may know the name. He's a QC. He's currently appearing for the police in the Lindt Cafe inquiry. But he's written this great big thick book on scientific misconduct, which covers some of this stuff, and it's probably worth a look. Or it's certainly worth having in a library.
How do we go about creating a culture in Australia where science and scientists are more revered, and then as a consequence of that, hopefully creating closer links between research institutes and university and business?
I don't think that there's all sorts of complexities. I don't think I'd really want to be revered. I mean, I'm lucky. I mean, I won a Nobel Prize, which if I was in Japan, everyone would know who I was. In Melbourne, nobody knows who I am. You know, I don't do anything with a ball. If you do something with a ball and a stick, or you jump into water and do something, you're okay. But that's good. I mean, I wouldn't want to be recognised in the street, really. That would be pretty awful. Jane must have it. Yeah, but it's different if you're a politician, I think. I think there's a lot of problems. There's a lot of sort of will to try and do something, but there are all sorts of things. We're not terribly good at translating our science into product. We're not that big a country. We do have actually a very good clinical trials culture here that's developed. And part of the problem is we don't have a very large research-oriented business culture. We've got one very big biotech firm, that's CSL, which is pretty successful. We've had smaller startups. We don't have a very adventurous financial culture and so forth. So we need to build these things. And we've been talking about this for quite a while. Melbourne University at the moment, Rufus Black, the Master of Ormond College, is starting a new course in entrepreneurism. We lack entrepreneurs. I think Australians are not natural entrepreneurs in the way Americans are. You know, Americans are selling lemonade by the time they're three and so forth. We're not like that. So it's a whole lot of things about our culture, our ways of doing things, our business culture that need to change, but they'll change rather slowly. And when we dismantle, for instance, our whole automobile industry and all the manufacturing that goes with it, that really takes that whole sort of type of industry out of the innovation process, because if people are not working with things, they don't innovate in them. And so it's difficult. And when we talk about innovation, if it just means innovation in financial systems so the banks can steal more money from you, what's the point of it? Yeah. You know, I can remember when bank robbers were people who robbed banks.
I've got a very quick one. This is a bit out of left field, I think. But you got through your very interesting, engaging talk without mentioning astronomy once, which is a very important part.
Exactly. Nobody contests astronomy. And nobody gets upset about astronomy. We give vast amounts of money to astronomy.
Yes.
The politicians give lots of money. It has no obvious spin-off for us, but we don't have any problem getting people to give money for astronomy. Nobody's insisting that the astronomers take out patents. They do sometimes. They make detectors and all sorts of things. We love astronomy. I like Brian Schmidt. He's an astronomer. But, you know, the astronomers use exactly the sort of mathematical modelling things and so forth that the climate scientists
That's
do.
Right.
The bankers use the same mathematical modelling. The bankers steal modellers from climate science. We steal modellers from climate science for biology. The gambling industry steals climate science modellers. So if you've got a grandchild or something who's going into university, tell them to keep their computational skills up. So even if they start being very altruistic and they want to do medical research, they can always go to the dark side and earn a lot more money. And they can keep you in your old age if your super is going, you know. If Turnbull is stealing your super.
Yes, one last one.
I was just going to follow on from that question in terms of what advice you have for high school students in terms of keeping up with STEM subjects, or what types of how useful further studying science is for them?
Usually, I mean, if you're talking about high school students, they've either decided that they really want to go in the science direction or not by then, usually. Just looking at the university, we do get occasional students from the good private schools and so forth who want to go into science. Often they've first done medicine, and then they've got bored because they're very bright and they want to do more research, or they want to do advanced knowledge. So we sometimes see that. But a lot of the kids we get coming into science come from country high schools, or they come from Catholic girls' schools, K Catholic girls' schools do pretty well getting people interested in science. And they're not nuns anymore, of course, as we know. So, and so I think actually to go into science at the moment in Australia, you'd probably have to be a bit naive, which is the kid coming from the country high school. I mean, Richard Larkins, who's a wonderful guy, was Dean of Medicine in Melbourne. He went to Melbourne Grammar on a scholarship, and of course, you know, it's a very prestigious school. And he was describing to me the other night how he went along to a sort of an open evening at Melbourne Grammar. Very good school, very bright students, and really top notch. And there were various people who came in and talked about careers. So there was a banker who came in and talked about banking, and there was an accountant who talked about accountancy, someone who talked about law. And he decided, rather than talk about medicine, I think someone else was talking about medicine, he thought he'd talk about research. And he said, I gave a wonderful talk. It was really inspirational. And he was very pleased with his talk. And then they all went, and this is a bit like, you know, if I go to a writer's festival, and they sit me at the table to do a book signing next to Jermaine De Greer or Tom Keneally. It's kind of depressing because, you know, the three people who want their book signed and then there's this line that goes around the block. But, and this is what happened to him. When he finished, he sat at his booth and no one came over. And they were all massed over at the banking guy and the accountancy, you know. Well, these are exciting fields. I mean, accountancy is exciting, you know, they go to jail and everything, it's good. And it's a very exciting field. And so eventually someone comes and he says to himself, it's quality, not quantity that counts. And this guy says, I really want to do astrophysics. I mean, that's really what I'm keen to do. I want to do astrophysics. And he's talking to him, he says, oh, this is what you do and this is what you do. And then the kid says, but first, I'm going into investment banking so I can make some money and support my lifestyle. And so Richard says to him, do you realize astrophysicists usually do their best work before they're 25? And so no signal. So it's the naive kids who go into science. Now, it's not that people don't make money out of science. Some people make a lot of money out of science. Some of my American friends have made lots of money. Ian Fraser made a lot of money out of science through his Gardasil vaccine. Some people do very well out of it. But that's the perception out there, and you can't blame kids for wanting to have jobs, and they want to have everything. So, I think some of us we're the last of the frugals, right?
Well, I think we'll have to stop here. Thanks very much, Peter. This has been a wonderful journey, with a lot of humour and a lot of thoughtful asides, and very interesting night. So, on behalf of everyone, I'd like to thank you very much for coming and speaking to us.